In the matter of T.L. versus Jack Goldberg, M.D., can we please have appearances of counsel? Welcome, counsel. Mr. Quell.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I would like to preserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Fine.
I'd first note that the issue before this Court is not whether my client's testimony at trial was a material variance from his discovery answers, or whether his previous representative violated a duty to the court. Rather, the issue before this court is whether the plaintiff waived consideration of the alleged error by failing to object to it at trial. It is the ramifications of this inexplicable failure to object, as the majority described it, that Judge Currier cited as her disagreement with the panel majority. I respectfully submit that Judge Currier was correct and that this court should adopt her reasoning. Indeed, I would further suggest that this court make it clear that when the issue concerns the admission of evidence, a party which does not object presumptively waives consideration of the matter and any claim of prejudice if there is a reasonable strategy that the attorney might have been employing by not objecting. Enacting such a rule would prevent the plain error standard, which was designed to be a rare exception, from swallowing the rule requiring objections to be posed. It would further the strong policy considerations of judicial economy and fairness to the litigants by giving trial judges the opportunity to correct any claimed error before prejudice can occur. Here's a perfect example. We had a massive 4-week trial, which has been ordered to a retrial based on the alleged prejudice from the mention of the 2009 article. A prejudice which may have been completely avoided had the plaintiff's counsel timely objected. There can be no question that trial judges possess significant powers to prevent prejudice from accruing, but only if they're given the opportunity to exercise those powers. They may issue directives to witnesses and attorneys, employ sanctions, preclude evidence, issue corrective instructions, and so forth. For the reasons that Judge Currier highlighted, there was clearly reason to believe that the plaintiff's lack of objection in this case was a strategic choice. The plaintiff's counsel has been given multiple chances to explain why he didn't object when Dr. Goldberg first mentioned the 2009 article. He has failed to articulate a reasonable response. He stated he didn't object because he wasn't sure how the jury would perceive it. Well, there was nothing to perceive. The witness had merely identified the 2009 article. Judge LeBond could have clarified and eliminated any possible prejudice right there had there been an objection. He further claimed not to know what the substance of the article was. Well, this is a reason to object, not a reason to withhold objection. By far, the most reasonable explanation for that inexplicable silence is that which Judge Currier detailed in her dissent, that the plaintiff's counsel simply did not believe that the admission of this evidence was at all harmful, and that it, in fact, furthered the position of the plaintiff that she was not a proper candidate for the prescription of Pegasus because she suffered from depression and interferon toxicity, which the plaintiff believed that this 2009 article furthered. Finally, requiring an objection would be in keeping with the plain error standard itself because it's designed to provide a backstop when necessary to prevent injustice. Now, there is simply no injustice in finding a waiver when a party has the full and fair opportunity to object but strategically chooses not to. Now, with regard to the issues raised by the amicus, I think that the issues were adequately covered in the briefing, and so I would leave it at that. At this point, I'd be happy to address any questions that the court may have.
So you said you suggested the adoption of a rule that no objection coupled with a reasonable strategy should amount to waiver. Tell us what evidence there is that this was a strategy engaged in by your adversary. I don't see very much in the cross-examination that would bear that out.
I believe that when you look at what they're claiming the prejudice was, In other words, that they're saying that the article, in fact, supported their position with regard to the interferon toxicity and the depression. There is a dispute between the parties as to whether or not, this plaintiff was a candidate for this drug. Their expert claimed, because of these issues, that she was not. Our expert said, no, she was, because of the type of depression that she had and the specifics of her reaction to the interferon. The important thing to remember about this study we're talking about here was a clinical study to determine the effects of this drug on a number of related conditions, one of them ET, which she suffered from, the other one P. vera. The exclusion criteria are basically designed to take out those patients who may have a condition that would invalidate the study. Even the plaintiff's expert conceded that exclusion criteria in these studies does not affect the standard of care. A doctor can, under the standard of care, still prescribe the drug to a person who would be excluded from the study, because they're two different things. One is the standard of care, and the other is, do we want someone in here who might screw up the results? We want to be crystal clear as to what scientifically we're finding here. And if someone who has depression already, well, the finding, if they end up with depression in the study, it may not be an effect of the drug, it may be an effect of the pre-existing condition.
Let me ask you,
but that doesn't necessarily mean that.
Sure. Do you concede that there was a McKinney violation, that you guys violated McKinney?
What I would say is this. I would say that was what the finding was, and Judge Perrier seemed to agree.
I'm asking you.
I don't think there was at all, and I'll tell you why. Because in McKinney, the important fact in McKinney, if I have it right here, was the attorney in that case conceded that he knew before trial that the witness was going to change their testimony. Conceded this. This was not a question in that case. Here, my client's previous attorney never made any such concession, and in fact said the opposite, that he didn't intend for this information to come out. He had no idea about it before it actually came out.
You can see that there was a complete variance between the deposition testimony and the trial testimony.
I would say objectively there is. Now, I would also add that I think that if you were to sit down and speak to Dr. Goldberg, what you would find out was that he was answering questions. How can I put this gently? The questions he was answering were added caveats and changes in his own mind. He wasn't answering the questions that were necessarily given to him. He was interpreting a certain way and answering. So, for example, you would ask him, did you know about such and such? And he would say, well, I knew about it, but what you must be willingly asking is about
I don't have to. To consider but, hypotheticals, I have the deposition testimony. Are you aware of any studies in the Journal of Clinical Oncology pertaining to the use of pegylated interferon to treat patients? Okay, so that's the deposition testimony. And we know that the trial testimony is, he says, in 2005, the investigators at MD Anderson took pegylated interferon and tested it in the clinical trial to patients with ET. Okay, that is directly contradictory.
I would agree with you that objectively it is. But what I'm also
subjectively
he did put it this way, subjectively he wasn't intending to try to do a bait and switch or to sandbag anyone or anything like that. When asked about the first question, he was more or less talking about, were you aware of the conclusion and studies and release. He was adding different things in his head. He was trying to kind of put it in a perspective that made sense to him, but I can't make an excuse and say no, that objectively it was invariance. But that just then raises the question, when the plaintiff is at trial and he raises this 2009 study, a 2009 article, I think it's then incumbent upon the plaintiff to then object, because then...
So he didn't object. We know he didn't object. And I wanted you to flesh out your answer on how we know that that was strategic, but let me come back to the answer that you gave earlier as well. You described what Dr. Goldberg talked about in terms of the exclusions. Was he accurate in his representation of what the study said, his testimony was that the patients that were excluded were those with major depression and only those. Is that accurate? Is that consistent with what the study said?
What the study criteria were. Now, what you have to understand is that the study started in 2005, and I put in my brief the long form of what all the exclusions were.
May I ask you to just clarify, tell us where in the study you're relying on. I'm looking at PA 57, and it only speaks about depression, not major depression. Is there another part to look at?
Well, okay, let me see if I can be here.
Does the study somewhere speak to major depression?
Right. If you look on pages 6 and 7 of my brief, I quote DA 134 and 135. That is the initial description in the 2005 listing of the study. Now, the 2009 results, this is the same study, 2005 study and 2009 results. When they published the 2009 results, they listed a summary of the exclusions, which mentioned depression. It didn't detail exactly what types of depression. It did just simply mention depression. But it's the same study. And so in that sense, again, I'm saying if there was an apparent conflict between that testimony, it's explained by the fact that this is the same study. The long form of what the actual exclusions were weren't copied and repeated in the 2009 results.
Are you saying that the original exclusions in the study involve only major depression, and that as summed up in the final report of the study, the published results, it said depression?
Right, and it was a summary. It wasn't.
Yeah. Are you saying that it's unclear whether either the exclusion criteria changed over time, which does happen, or there was a summary that was inaccurate, or why that discrepancy existed?
What I'm saying is that the 2009 results merely contained a summary. It wasn't that there was any kind of change in the actual study criteria.
So what was the exclusion criteria of the study ultimately published in 2009?
Well, it was the 2009 article merely listed depression. Right.
What was the initial exclusion criteria?
I'm sorry?
At the beginning, what was the initial exclusion criteria?
I'm sorry, I'm hard of hearing.
At the beginning, what was the exclusion criteria when they began the study in 2005?
The exclusion criteria listed patients with a history of medically significant psychiatric disease, if not controlled, especially endogenous depression, does not include reactive depression, post-cancer diagnosis, psychosis, and bipolar disease, was the actual full
list. Is there a connection? Maybe you can help me with this. I'm not saying that it's a core issue. As a result of taking this medication, did she suffer? Is the plaintiff arguing she suffered a major depression?
No.
I understand. It's contraindicated for depression, but depression has nothing to do with the actual administration of this particular drug.
Except for that their expert is claiming that it was a breach of the standard of care because she suffered from depression. And patients
that it shouldn't have been given, but the giving of it doesn't have anything to do with, unless I'm mistaken about this from what I've read, with her suffering now a depressive condition for which she's suing?
Correct.
They have a causation theory. Tell me if I'm right about this. The plaintiff's expert has a causation theory that says that she should have it was a deviation from the standard of care to give her the medication because she had a condition that should have excluded her based on the exclusion criteria that were in the study. And therefore, if according to their theory, if the doctor had followed the standard of care, she never would have been given it, but that exclusion has nothing to do with what she says the drug did to her.
No, what I think that they're arguing is that under the standard of care, a patient who has this condition, a depression condition,
would not have been given the drug.
Standard of care does not permit the doctor.
This is a deviation expert. There's a causation expert coming later. This is the deviation
this
expert.
This is deviation.
And not causation. That's
not
a whole
causation.
Different issue.
Right. The exclusion criteria is only with regard to the study and not right. to the standard of care. Right. And that's really what, you know, one of our arguments here is it simply couldn't have caused, you know, the jury's verdict here, because even their expert would agree that the exclusion criteria in the study, and that's all the 2009 results talked about, was the exclusion criteria in the study has no effect on the standard of care. And since the question to the jury was about standard of care, not the exclusion criteria, even permitting the jury to hear evidence of exclusion criteria.
What did the package insert say about contraindications?
Well, they said that there is a contraindication, but that doesn't preclude doctor from prescribing anyway. And our doctor agreed that, you know, there is a contraindication, but it's more for major depression that she didn't have, and that therefore the standard of care that was applicable to this prescription was merely to, you know, properly monitor her and change and adjust her medicine if necessary.
Can you come back to your argument that this was a strategic move and tell us what supports that?
Well, I
think off the items first and then get into detail.
I think that the strategic move here on the plaintiff's part was this, was that their whole position was essentially what I laid out before, that a patient who had depression and interferon toxicity should not have been prescribed this medicine. I think that the strategy here was to say, okay, well, almost, you know, let the doctor hang himself. He starts talking about the 2009 results of the MD Anderson study, and with the exclusion criteria there, the plaintiff can then argue, hey, wait a second, you're saying that the 2009 article supports you, but this study doesn't support you because of the contraindications to the study. You're not sending people who have depression to this study, you know, because people who have the depression shouldn't be getting this medicine.
Wasn't it also that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Don't the plaintiff's own arguments that the motion provide the evidence that it was a strategy? He says, I didn't know how the jury was going to take it. That suggests that I might object, but it may be taken the wrong way. That's a strategy every attorney does. And by the way, he could ask the judge to go to sidebar and made the objection there that the jury didn't hear it. And then he says, I didn't have the material to cross-examine the witness on. That's certainly not a reason not to object. As a matter of fact, there's more of a reason to object. So doesn't that itself show that it was a strategic
absolutely
move?
I believe it does. I believe it does.
At the very least, I take it your argument is it could not have been inadvertent, because the plaintiff had made a motion in limine on this precise issue. The plaintiff's attorney would have had to be asleep, literally at the switch at counsel's table, for this to be going over his head.
I don't think that they can argue that he didn't know what was going on, because he was asked about it, and he, as Your Honor just noted, I mean, he said on the record, you know, that he was aware of it, he considered it, and these were the reasons why.
Everyone's attention was focused on this issue. This isn't something that could have just been slipped in without anyone not knowing.
No.
I mean, there was a dialogue on this very issue about what was not going to be permissible.
Right.
The judge gave an order. Everyone knew it. Now, there may have been a violation, but everyone was on notice, yes?
Correct. And I mean, Judge Goldberg's, Dr. Goldberg's previous counsel put in his papers that he understood the order to be referring to learned treatises and not, you know, a commentary about an article. If the plaintiff disagreed, you know, the time to bring it up is when the article is mentioned.
So help us out on that point. On cross-examination, counsel tried to get into the distinction between major depression and just depression to suggest that by virtue of having depression alone, one should have been excluded from the study. But that was shut down. That was objected to and never made it to the jury.
That was in reference to a 2010 study. There was testimony from the plaintiff's expert, though, about that, the very point about the exclusion criteria and whether or not.
So in analyzing prejudice, should we consider that that this dispute never made it to the jury? To the extent it was a strategy, it never got off the ground even.
I think it did get off the ground because I think that they were confused. They were, in essence, conflating the issue of the exclusion criteria. I mean, it's our position that the exclusion criteria does not affect the standard of care. Their experts seem to agree with us, but on the other hand, the expert said, if you have depression, that should preclude you from getting the medicine under the standard of care. So, you know, we're making the distinction between the two. I don't know whether the plaintiff, in their strategy, was making the distinction between
the two. Well, I'm looking at page 180 of the transcript, where the argument by Dr. Goldberg's attorney was, he's talking about the 2010 study, and then counsel says, no, the other one, meaning the published one that we've been talking about, and then that just ends with a conclusory statement, and I'm keeping it out under 403.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the position from the plaintiff's strategy From the plaintiff's strategy perspective, was essentially to say, you know, the exclusion criteria mimics the standard of care criteria, because that's essentially what their expert was positive.
Is it your, and tell me if this is, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but are you saying that the strategy that was behind the lack of an objection was, the doctor's really on very shaky ground here with this 2009 study, and I, as plaintiff's counsel, can turn that around to make it appear that the exclusion criteria is the standard of care and strengthen my case.
That's exactly right, yeah.
That's the strategy that you say the plaintiff's counsel was applying when he decided not to object.
I believe that's a reasonable view of what happened. And part of the reason why in my statement I talked about if there's any reasonable strategy that the attorney might have been employing. The reason why I phrase it that way is this. I can't get in his head. I can see what I think his strategy was, but sometimes you have a strategy in your head. It's completely subjective. You're following it. Maybe you're adjusting it as the case goes along. The impossibility after the fact of knowing exactly what he meant, exactly what he was thinking at that exact moment.
It's not just him. From my perspective, there's a trial judge. The trial judge has to figure out, should I be interceding at this particular point? I have two really experienced attorneys before me who know how to object and know what they want in and know what they want to cross-examine. So it's asking the judge to step in. It's placing a high burden on him to substitute his judgment for what may be what he thinks are the strategic stratagems of the attorneys before him.
I think that's exactly right, and especially when you have two experienced attorneys, as we had in this case.
I'm confused about one. Talking about strategy and talking about exclusion criteria, and plaintiff trying to make the case and using the study to show depression is one of the exclusion criteria, and therefore, by allowing her to be prescribed this, by prescribing this when she suffers from depression was malpractice. That's kind of what the argument is about the strategy.
Yeah.
But I thought the testimony by the doctor and I think the chief touched on this, I didn't understand the answer, but I'm a little slow sometimes. I thought on the examination of the doctor specifically said, the study did not exclude depression. It excluded only major depression. And that's where, that's a kind of not only a big change of what his deposition testimony was, but it's an inaccurate statement of the study. That would be somewhat it would undermine their strategy. It would be somewhat prejudicial. Why is that not pertinent to our consideration?
Well, because as I explained before, that the study criteria themselves and the summary that was in the 2009
No, results. They're not inconsistent. Nothing's inconsistent about any of that. The study's exclusion criteria, according to the doctor, was major depression.
Correct.
Major depression is not considered in the 2009 statement or the 2010 summary. It's not in there.
Well, 2010 is different. We're talking about...
not saying it's... Every report, study, or summary you're referring to does not include major depression.
Okay, fair enough.
And the doctor said that was all that was excluded, which if they had a strategy, it was now undermined by a misstatement about what the study said, what the study included, what the study didn't include. Why is that not one of our considerations?
Well, because I would take issue with the premise. The 2005...
That's what I meant. I said 2009. I'm sorry.
2005 criteria made that distinction.
It did not exclude only major depression.
No, well...
It did not exclude only major depression.
When it was talking about the depression, it said it does not include reactive depression post-cancer diagnosis. In other words...
You're saying that's only some forms of depression.
It did not... I'm saying it one more time and tell me why I'm wrong. It did not exclude only major depression, which is what the doctor said it only excluded, which means that, according to the doc, I guess, and the strategy of the plaintiff, if I prescribed it for depression, that was not a concern. They didn't exclude that from the study.
Well, his position is that
did
the exclusion criteria are irrelevant to the standard of care.
I get that. Yeah. You're talking about... Okay. We're talking about their strategy. He testified that the study did not exclude depression.
By itself.
The study...
I'm sorry.
Excluded only major depression.
Correct.
The study did not exclude, either in the statement in 05 or the summary in 09, only major depression.
What I would say is...
Is that right or is that wrong?
What I would say is that he's reading the language that I just read and interpreting it...
He didn't do that.
...to mean that... As a matter of medical.
Tell us what language you're referring to. Can you give us a citation?
I'm sure. This is on page 6 and 7 of my brief. I lay out the initial 2005 criteria, and it's also located at DA 134 and 135.
Okay.
DA, right?
DA, yes. Now,
he wanted to explore this difference in front of the jury, and was not permitted to do so. Is that correct?
Based on the 2010 study.
Nope.
Nothing prevented them from discussing the 2005 criteria?
That's not what appears at the transcript on page 180.
I would have to... Let me see. Let me take a look at that.
There's discussion about 2010 and that 2010 is not relevant to the case. And then you have counsel saying, no, Dr. Goldberg talked about the other one, a reference to his earlier testimony to the 2005/2009 study, where he, Dr. Goldberg, said the exclusion criteria was major depression. But he's never allowed to develop that theme in front of the jury, and my question is, how does that bear on the issue of prejudice?
I'm sorry, and the page again?
180. Look at lines 10 through 15 in particular.
Unfortunately, I don't have the line numbers here on the brief.
Middle of the page. How about we do it this way? Counsel? Why don't you assume that he wanted to get into this distinction about the 2005-2009 study and was not allowed to? How does that bear on the issue of prejudice?
Well, here is what I would say to that. His statement is, in post-trial, he didn't know about the 2009 report until after trial. So my position would be that if, in fact, then you're claiming that, or you're...
But if he had been allowed to cross-examine, he might have learned about it through the cross-examination. A skillful cross-examiner could use the information to present to the jury. The 2010 fine wasn't, but 05 or 09 was certainly before the jury through the doctor's testimony, and counsel is not allowed to. The fact that he might not know what is said doesn't prevent you, contrary to what you hear, but never ask a question you don't know the answer to. Many times you can develop information through the cross-examination. He wasn't allowed to delve into the mistakes. Statements by the doctor that only major depression people were excluded, and he was not allowed to.
Well, I think that he could have addressed that point, maybe not with specific reference.
The judge said he couldn't.
I honestly haven't looked at this under that perspective. What I would ask is if you permit me on.
What's there to look at? He was told you can't go into that. He said, "I want to go through 05 to 09." You're not. What perspective are you talking about?
Honestly, Your Honor, I'm not prepared to answer this question.
You want to look back at the transcript and see what the...
Yeah, because I'm completely... Yeah. And I would like to, if Your Honors would permit, submit a short, maybe two...
Does it make a difference whether that limitation on that questioning was due to the in limine motion that was filed by plaintiffs and ruled on by the court? Is that what's at the nub of this curtailment of questioning that we're now focusing on?
I'll be honest with you, I didn't really focus on it, so I couldn't really say. I would like to the opportunity
has
to
anyone raised has the plaintiff raised that issue? Yeah. The issue that is now being discussed, is it raised by the plaintiff? This curtailment argument?
I'll be honest with regard to this specific portion of the trial. Yeah. I didn't focus on it. My focus was elsewhere. So I can't really make any definitive statements with regard to it.
Let's go on with your argument then.
That background.
Go on. We don't need a supplemental. Let's go on with your argument. Okay. Go ahead.
Because my position is basically this, that, you know, the failure to object is essentially what this case is all about. And, you know, any change or modification that the judge may have made in exercising his discretion, that would have been the time.
Are you saying that the failure to object is, if it's strategic and if the lawyer's explanation supports the argument that it is strategic, then that's as far as we go?
Yes.
We don't go into prejudice. Do we judge whether it was a good strategy or bad strategy?
I think you would have to look at whether it was strategy, because the essential claim of prejudice here is that it was prejudice that that this 2009 information got before the jury. And my point is that, okay, well, if that was the prejudice, then the time to alleviate that prejudice is when the witness makes the statement by objecting, and then the trial judge can. Now, if the trial judge, said, "I'm going to allow it," even though it was never mentioned before, and then they can make the claim after the fact that was prejudice, that's a different case. But at least then you had the opportunity for the judge to talk to the witnesses, talk to the attorneys at sidebar, to examine the whole thing, to establish a record, to see exactly what was going on that led to that point. There may have been a complete explanation for all of it, or there may not have been. But the point is that it all would have been examined and all would have been on the record, and the trial judge could have then exercised his discretion in making whatever ruling he would have made. But we don't have that here. So for them to say, okay, well, this testimony, this document was referred to, that was prejudicial to my client, it should have been excluded, but, oh, I didn't object because I didn't know how the jury was going to react, or I had no idea what it said. Well, that doesn't follow. I mean, that's when the objection should be made. And for us to sit here and say, well, you know, exactly what was the strategy, I think is...
Do you read that statement about I didn't know how the jury was going to react as I didn't want to object in front of the jury as opposed to a sidebar, or that the lawyer was saying it? I wasn't sure how this would all play out in terms of how I did with this jury. In other words, the substance of the objection.
I think it could be read either way, but either way, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me, because you could take it to sidebar if you had an objection or you had a concern about how the jury would react to the actual statement of objection.
If you're concerned with a potential violation of an eliminate order, you would go to sidebar.
I'm sorry.
You would go to sidebar if your objection were,
sure.
Your Honor, you had an eliminate motion on this and this just went over the line. That would be something that would
right, and then the judge could have, again, heard from defense counsel as to, you know, what their position was and made a ruling accordingly.
But there was cross-examination on the 2005-2009 study, correct?
Say again?
There was cross-examination on 2005-2009.
Yeah, that study is very well known, and my client testified to it from that position forward.
So it was not utterly off limits here. It was covered in front of the jury, correct?
Right, and again, I can't really state with regard to that
one
the discussion 180. My understanding is that had to do with the 2010 study, and that's why it was excluded.
The cross on 2005-2009, can you tell us how extensive it was?
I'm sorry?
How extensive was the cross-examination on the 2005-2009 study?
I don't think it was tremendously extensive, but how many pages now I couldn't say.
I only see a few questions at 147 and 148, which hardly probe, and that's why I was wondering if there was another spot where that was developed on cross.
I don't believe it was. Like I said, I don't think it was very extensive at all, but he did bring it up. Mostly, I think, because when you look at the summary, the testimony from his expert, they were really hammering the point that, you know, this was an experimental drug. It was a new drug.
And basically suggesting that the doctor didn't know what he was doing in prescribing this drug for this patient at that time. Were you a maverick, I think, was the question, right?
Well, that was a violation of standard of care, and our expert disagreed. It was a battle of the experts.
Counsel, before you sit down, do you want to give us a tick off why you perceive there's no prejudice here?
There's no prejudice because a party that chooses not to object to evidence being admitted, there's no injustice in having a strategy fail. If you decide that certain evidence, it's okay for it to come in, and you know you end up losing your case. You know, it's simply just a strategy that didn't work out. I don't think that, you know, when you look at what the question is under the plain error standard, it's a matter of injustice. And it's not strictly prejudice, but it's injustice. And again, you know, if you're following that strategy and it doesn't work out, there's no injustice, especially when you're given a full and fair opportunity to make the objection at the time and you don't choose to.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Sayers.
May it please the court. Good morning again. I don't think we can gloss over that it was mandatory for defense counsel to advise myself that there's going to be a change in the testimony. There's going to be a change in what Dr. Goldberg said in his answers to interrogatories. And despite what I said during the eliminate motion and despite the court's ruling, we have an article that we're going to refer to during Dr. Goldberg's deposition trial testimony. An article that apparently they had since June 2013, 2 years before the trial and after Dr. Goldberg's deposition. I don't think we can gloss over that it was mandatory that I be advised of that. So what they're saying here is, oh, I should have objected. It's like saying that yes, I did run through the stop sign at 60 miles per hour. You should have taken a different way home, Mr. Sayers. It's not my error. I'm not the one violating the McKinney. I'm not the one violating the court's order. I'm not the one changing my sworn testimony. And certainly after 4 weeks of trial in a contested case with the last witness testifying, and he says something that sounds shocking to me as I'm listening to it, there's always strategy involved in deciding, is this something I'm going to object to? How's the jury going to perceive this? Where is this coming from, and how much of this is he going to get into on this testimony? And then frankly, I was shocked to hear it, and I certainly could have objected, but I had done the research on Pegasus for this case. We had the literature, and this is why one of the reasons I moved in limine to bar the defendant from having any literature, because they hadn't produced any. So we had all the literature, they had none. So when I hear this testimony without a reference to a specific article, something from the Journal of Clinical Oncology in 2009, I didn't want to object the last witness, last day of trial, on something that hopefully wasn't going to be covered in much depth. And when I instinctively knew this couldn't possibly be what he's saying. And I felt...
I'm sorry, you said you instinctively knew it couldn't possibly be what he's saying?
Right. Okay, Dr. Goldberg saying that it was acceptable to prescribe Pegasus to patients with depression. That cannot possibly be, because I had done the research and we had the articles. And so instinctively, I just felt something was not right.
Well, when it went further than you thought when you were mulling whether to object or not, why didn't you make a motion to strike and instruct the jury to disregard the doctor's testimony completely because it violated a rule of one of the court's rulings?
Yeah, I could have. That was one option, correct? I could have.
It was an option to do nothing?
Well, my option was to find out what the truth was. And I decided after the testimony.
So it was a trial strategy to find out what the truth was, but if you'd have objected, we wouldn't have this problem where all this testimony came out.
Well,
if you had moved to strike, the jury wouldn't have been able to consider it.
That's the exact same argument I just made before you, Justice, is that how am I to be blamed for the defendant running the red light?
Now, this is very different. You're a trial. It's a doctor's testifying. He's violated the court's ruling. You're not sure how far he's going to go, so you decide not to object. Now he goes further, and you move to strike. Well, you could have gone up the sidebar and said, Judge, we haven't heard this before. I want to know where it's going before he goes any further.
Well, the other part of it is, like I said, instinctively I knew something wasn't right, but I didn't have the article. I didn't have the substance of the article. So what if I was incorrect in my assumption that what he's saying isn't true? What if, in fact, the article says exactly what it says?
It had been barred, but you're saying that they violated the court's ruling. Whatever it said, it could have been kept out by a timely objection, kept out.
Of course it could have been. But, again, as the appellate division said, the failure to object is not dispositive when you have a McKinney violation like we had in this case. And, in fact, when I did get the article, what it showed is that he was not only violated McKinney, but he gave completely false and misleading information to the jury.
So this is the problem when someone can object and doesn't. You can't have it like both ways. I won't object now. Maybe I can get some benefit out of this. And even if it doesn't work, I'll move for a mistrial. I'll get two bites of this. That's our whole legal framework for requiring timely objections.
Right.
So why shouldn't we be implementing that line of jurisprudence here?
Because, Justice, I'm not the one who gave the false testimony. I'm not the one...
You use the example of a car going through a red light.
Right.
You're in a position to stop the car from going through the red light. As soon as the doctor said a single thing that you knew was violative of the order, in limine order, that you had implemented, you could have just objected and gone to sidebar and said, Judge, this witness is doing the very thing that we said was not supposed to occur. And that would have been the end of it.
Well, the bell was already rung in one respect, in that the jury heard this testimony. It was brief, on direct. And so, sure, Monday morning quarterback, I could have done that. But as I said, it was an extensive 4-week trial. This is the last witness. And, every decision about whether to object or not object is a strategy.
I'm trying to understand how the plain error standard works here. Is it the are we using plain error on the part of the trial judge, that the trial judge had some affirmative obligation hearing this testimony to intervene on his own?
No. No, it's a plain error because this should have been disclosed to me.
No, I get that.
And I didn't, but now I'm prejudiced by the testimony.
You could have objected, you didn't object, so now you're arguing this was plain error. Am I mistaken about your theory here?
You're correct.
So the question is, I'm trying to understand who committed the plain error. Was it the trial judge by not interceding and stopping it on his own?
It was at the motion for a new trial when I had the information finally before me, the substance of the article, which I didn't have before, that said not only is depression an exclusion criteria for this drug, for this condition, but also prior interferon toxicity, which he also had, and which our experts said was another reason not to give this medication. When I had the full set of information about this article and raised it in a post-trial motion, that's when the plain error standard.
Maybe I misheard you, counsel. I thought you said earlier that the reason you moved the bar pre-trial is because you had all the reports and all the information.
Correct.
So now you're telling us that you just received it? Maybe I misunderstood you. I thought you said that you moved the bar because you had all the information from all the reports, and that's why you moved the bar to Dr. Mann testifying about these reports.
That's correct.
And now you're telling me, but I think you're saying now that you didn't have the information until after the trial was over.
Plaintiff identified in discovery the articles which our experts were going to rely upon in support of their opinions. I had done research. They had done research. I didn't know about this 2009 article.
So you didn't have that one?
I didn't have it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then, so after Dr. Goldberg testifies, I went and found it.
Okay.
And it says...
I misunderstood you. I thought you said you had it beforehand.
No, I didn't. It says exactly what our experts say, what they said in their affirmative testimony, and it undermines what Dr. Goldberg said on stand when you read the article.
The question of whether one did or did not object isn't the end of the analysis. But if it was a strategic decision, that, of course, factors in. So I'd like to give you an opportunity to tell us, and you've covered it a bit already, why you did not object.
Yeah, well, it wasn't strategy per se. First of all, I was shocked to hear it. So I'm now trying to absorb this information. It's been a four-week trial, and this is the last witness. The jury's heard all this testimony already. Now the defendant is on the stand, and they don't have an actual article, but he references a study from a journal. So my decision was, we call it strategy or not, I don't know what the article says. I can object, and I don't know how the court's going to rule. And what if it's an article that actually, and he lets it in, what if it's an article that actually says what he says?
You could have gone to sidebar and asked for a disclosure. This wasn't a blurt out like 2009. This was a line of questioning that was going on, question after question, on 2009.
Yeah.
If you had any doubt, you could have gone, what is he talking about, this 2009 article? I want a proffer right now. What's in that article? No?
That was an option. I agree, but
I'm trying to answer
the justice's question, but
no, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, so there was no quote unquote strategy because I didn't have the substance of the article. It was more important to me at this point of the case to find out what is he talking about and to get the actual truth of the matter about the article.
And you do that by asking for a sidebar and saying, Your Honor, I'm very concerned that you have a motion, you have an order in limine barring articles. I'm hearing testimony from this witness that seems to be suggesting at the time he prescribed this that he was relying on this particular article. I need to know exactly what this is because I think this is over the line of Your Honor's opinion.
And I'm
with all your experience, you know how to do that.
I agree, but as the appellate division, the majority stated, and they thought it was important enough to publish, to have the opinion published, This issue of whether I should object or not would have been completely avoided had the obligation, had the defense counsel and defendant met their obligation to advise me that they're going to refer
so
to
the That's always the case with an objection. I mean, you could say, in that case, plain error always wins the day, because my adversary hadn't done something wrong, I wouldn't have been obliged to decide whether or not to object, and therefore forget that I didn't object. That logic, respectfully, I think, it could sweep in every single situation where a lawyer decides not to object. You know, they're the bad guys because they did the bad thing, so why is everybody looking at me on why I didn't object? That throws out the plain error standard, doesn't it?
Well, like I said, Monday morning quarterback, I could have objected, but what we found out is the doctor gave false testimony. So
but the value of an objection, which is recognized over and over in the case law, is the real-time, real-world trial judge intervention to keep the trial on track and make it a fair trial. Fairness
right.
being important. The trial judge has been there for 4 weeks with you. Trial judge knows the case, knows the testimony, and can make the correction before anything goes in front of the jury that is a problem and potentially puts the fairness of the trial into question. I mean, that isn't that over and over what the court says about the value of an objection?
It's true, Justice. And then, but to address the issue of prejudice, I did try and get this information on the exclusion criteria on cross-examination with Dr. Goldberg from the 2010 article, which we had in our case, and I was forbid from doing that, not knowing what the 2009 article stated.
So that does go to the Chief's question earlier. So what you were cut off from doing was using the 2010 article?
Correct, which we supplied, which specifically stated that the exclusion criteria is not just major depression, it's depression and interferon intolerance.
Were you barred from using, on cross-examination of the doctor, from asking the doctor about his reference to the 2009 article?
I wasn't forbade from it, but I didn't have the article, so I'm not going to ask him something I didn't have the information on. And in fact, I only asked like one thing: wasn't this about some other condition and not ET? And that was it.
So you wanted to bring up the 2010 study in order to potentially refute the 2009 article, which you didn't have? Is that what you're telling
Correct.
Us?
Correct. And I had the 2010 article, which our experts had relied upon.
So why were you barred from asking questions about the 2010 article?
The judge ruled that was a 403 exclusion, and I'm not sure why.
But it wasn't based on the in limine ruling. It was it was a different evidential basis.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
I want to give you an opportunity to explain your statement that you're waiting to hear what the truth was coming from Dr. Goldberg.
No, from actually having the article, from knowing what it said, because as I mentioned,
while he was testifying. Like, I'm still trying to understand why you would want to hear something coming out of Goldberg's mouth that you didn't know anything about, that wasn't in discovery, like why you just wouldn't object at that moment and demand some sort of proffer at sidebar.
Right. I understand. My position, again, as I said, I was shocked to hear it. I certainly could have objected, but instinctively something didn't sound right, and I wanted to find out the truthful information, and I guess I missed the opportunity to object, and that's what happened.
So let's go on to the question of prejudice. You've highlighted one way in which you've suggested you were prejudiced. Tell us, are there any others?
Certainly, because now before the jury is Dr. Goldberg saying, oh, I'm not a maverick, I'm not the only one prescribing Pegasus for ET. Look, there's a study that says there are other people are looking into this too, and it includes people who have depression. And so I'm just doing what other people have done or doing. So, and in fact, were prejudiced because, let's say they had disclosed this information to me before trial. I could have had an option. I could have moved to bar it because it was late or contrary to the prior testimony. But then I would have had the article, and I wouldn't have moved to bar it. The article is useful to me, as it turns out, and I would have asked to redepose the doctor and would have been before the jury that he said one thing at one time, now he's saying another thing, and now he's saying that this is supports his position when actually the article says something else. So it prejudices me in the way I presented the case. Our case was in. This was the very last witness, and so there was no way to go back and address what he's saying. So we're prejudiced in multiple ways.
Other questions?
No.
Anything you'd like to add?
No, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Gold.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. 30-some years ago, I went to an Apple convention, and there was a seminar for wives of trial lawyers. Things have changed a little bit, but the concept was, how do you live with your husband when he's on trial? There are all of these things that go on in our minds as trial attorneys. What did I screw up today? Who's tomorrow? How am I getting the next witness in? And why should I ever have to, in that thought process, think that fundamental testimony is going to change? That's the issue here. So what Justice Albin first asked, was there a McKinney violation? The answer is yes. And the other answer is the plain error is the trial judge's. When a McKinney violation occurs, it is the trial judge's obligation to say, whoa, where are we going?
So you're saying in this setting, this trial judge was obligated, looking at the lawyers in the room, the experience in that room, and seeing no ripple of anything, maybe, I don't know what the atmosphere was like.
For the following reason, you're putting the, and this works plaintiff or defendant, I don't care, this is a neutral argument. You're putting the victim in an impossible position. He's got to make a decision on the spur of the moment.
Isn't that what trial attorneys do? Make decisions on the spur of the moment?
But this is different.
How is it different?
Because
there's improper testimony, it violates an order, and you're sitting there and you object. Say, Your Honor, can we approach? You go to sidebar, you say, he's violating the order, I object, I don't know what he's going to say, but it should be barred. Why should you be put in that position? That's what you get your fee for acting as an attorney for your client and trying a case.
Only if I win, I get my fee, but
that's how I got my fee. I don't know how you get yours, but that's how I got my fee, trying cases.
The fact is that McKinney violations are different from other violations. I know of no other case except McKinney, where there is an ethical obligation on the attorney who's going to present the evidence.
There's something more here. This isn't just a McKinney violation. It's the plaintiff's attorney moved in limine to exclude. Okay? So this is on the antenna of the attorney. Like, this is not something you can miss. I've asked for the exclusion, and when it comes up, there's no objection. But now we're shifting the responsibility to the trial judge? I'm not saying the trial judge maybe, as out of an excess of caution, maybe should have stopped. But I'm trying to understand, why isn't the responsibility on the attorney who is knowledgeable, who knows this issue, raised the issue, could have objected, and there's not just a blurt out. There's a line of questions at any point at which the plaintiff's attorney could have objected. Go ahead.
And the answer to the question is, it is NJAJ's position that when a McKinney violation occurs, that's it.
Where do
game,
you rely on? What do you rely on? Where does McKinney say the judge must intervene?
I didn't say the judge must.
You did earlier.
No. I said that it would have been appropriate for the judge here. But I'm not saying that that McKinney says the judge has to.
I think Justice Patterson asked the question. Why is it different than any other case where there may be a McKinney violation than in this case in particular the judge had an obligation to intercede?
because there had been so much discussion about it, because the judge was assumed it was the end of the case. I'm not saying, don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm not saying in all cases.
Isn't McKinney a little different from this? And McKinney, the nurse had testified during depositions that she had basically no involvement. Summary judgment was granted. She was not called as a witness, not as a party. There was no attorney for her there. She was a witness. And then she changed her testimony to indicate perhaps she had more to do with it. But
even worse.
That's different.
Even worse here. Even worse here.
How do you figure?
Because here, the attorney obviously knows that the doctor is going to rely on this article because he's asking him questions about it. You know,
asked him, "Are you a maverick?" I mean, I don't. Unless I'm missing something, he didn't say, "Here's the 2009 article. Let's talk about it."
You know, we talk about criticizing the plaintiff's attorney. The defense attorney obviously knows what his witness is going to say. If he doesn't, he shouldn't be asking him the question.
Respectfully, it's not about criticism of anybody. It's the question is whether the plain error. There's really one question in this case, as you know, and you wrote a very fine brief, and obviously we appreciate your involvement as we always do. The question is whether this was plain error.
I agree.
So it's not a question of who did what before.
And
you always have a plain error issue when somebody's done something that's potentially objectionable.
Okay.
So blame is not here.
Okay. I appreciate that. My point here is, and the significance of McKinney is, and I'll say it again, it's the only case I know of where an evidentiary standard is an ethical standard. It's a higher standard than merely saying hearsay.
But with McKinney, we had something different that we don't have here. In McKinney, when the error, the lack of information, change in position became known, positions had changed to the detriment that could not be remedied by anything other than a new trial because people had been dismissed from the action that could be pointed to as now responsible parties. Here, the issue is coming up in the context of a time in trial when there were other options that were available and could have been used as a remedy. So you're arguing that the only remedy is a new trial, and yet we have a very, very different setting. Even if we assume, and I'm just going to assume for purposes of my argument, that this is equivalent to the kind of McKinney failure that happened in that case, and I was on that court. Assuming this is a McKinney violation, we have a different setting altogether, and I'm not sure that the same remedy applies.
Well, we know we have a McKinney violation because Justice Auld been asked the question and got, disagree.
That's not an answer, though. And the answer is that in this case, even the dissent, and this is here on a dissent, assume for purposes of the prejudicial question in front of Judge Currier, that there was a violation and didn't dispute it.
Okay.
So we're going to have to accept it for purposes of our analysis of the question.
Fair enough. Your question is, does the level of prejudice arise to a level that should require a new trial? And my answer to the question is very simple. Anytime there's a McKinney violation, the answer to that question is yes, and we'll see where the...
Think about
that's
that
an
now.
Extension think, of McKinney. Yeah.
It is an extension of McKinney.
Think about the wrong the policy implications of what you're saying.
Yeah.
A plaintiff's attorney, could be a defense attorney, sits back, hears that there's a McKinney violation, just let it go. If I win, beautiful. If I lose, it's a new trial. Is that what we want to encourage?
Well, I think we want to discourage McKinney violations. I think that's what we want to discourage
Do we want to encourage attorneys gaming the system and purposely not objecting because they have hidden away a fatal flaw in the case that they can rely on if they don't win the case?
It's the opposite, with due respect. We don't want either side to have a trick card up their sleeve to be played at the right moment.
No, we want to encourage attorneys to make timely objections so any error can be cured, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Your theory is discouraging that. Whenever there's a McKinney violation, it's going to cause a new trial. Then you can just sit back, let it sit there, and let it explode when you want.
No. With due respect, I don't see it that way. Our discovery rules are designed so that you tell the adversary before trial any changes that are going to happen.
And that raises my next question for you. You're saying that Kinney is somehow unique because there's an ethical obligation on the part of the lawyer to make the disclosure. Lawyers, for plaintiffs, for defendants, for everybody, have ethical disclosure requirements that are very closely tied in with the discovery rules. So respectfully, I don't see McKinney as anything different. You're saying, oh, this should be special and there's no requirement of an objection. Well, when lawyers produce documents and have obligations to produce documents, the ethics rules address those as well as the discovery rules. Everything you're saying applies to a document surfacing at trial.
And there's a case that will come to me that discusses that. My point was, and if I wasn't clear on this, McKinney is the only case I know of where this court has premised the evidentiary requirement on an ethical requirement.
But discovery has all kinds of ethical requirements.
I agree.
So if you're saying this is so, and I understand you're making an argument, oh, this is only McKinney. McKinney's special. We can kind of do away with plain error on McKinney, and it won't really do that much because it's really special. The same principles would apply to any violation of a discovery obligation that surfaces at trial. You're essentially saying that's ethical. Therefore, you don't have to put the onus on the other side to object if something came in, if an undisclosed document surfaced at trial.
I see that a little differently, with due respect. If a document comes forth at trial that I haven't seen before, it's still, in my mind, a small McKinney violation. It's a discovery violation. You want to use a document now. You want to use testimony now. You want to change the facts after the game is in play.
McKinney's really about witness testimony.
It's about witness testimony, but I don't think it's a stretch to say.
Well, I don't want to belabor it. But all I'm saying is that you're saying McKinney's something very sui generis, and I would respectfully suggest that lawyers have ethical obligations that go well beyond.
Agree 100%. All I'm saying is this court, it's the only case I know where this court has elevated the reason for the evidence requirement to be equivalent to an ethical violation.
Does McKinney require the aggrieved party to show prejudice?
Yes. I think in any fair reading it has to.
And
because if the testimony is of an unimportant issue, that's not going to make any difference. Who cares?
Was there prejudice here, even though, to the plaintiff, and frankly, it might explain some of his reason for not jumping up and doing anything, that his own expert had already testified in his part of the case that you could prescribe the medication to somebody with depression? Does that undermine the prejudice argument and explain why maybe plaintiff's counsel didn't jump up and object?
Again, I think...
In light of that, how do you show prejudice?
The prejudice is he doesn't know what the doctor is going to testify.
I get that. And
so how does he know if the doctor is right or wrong or his doctor is right or wrong? That's the hard question here. If
where the trial judge comes in. I mean, that is certainly a very difficult position. I totally agree with you for a trial lawyer to be in on the last day of trial or any day of trial. But that's where you go to your judge. You go to your judge and you fix it.
They try to fix it.
You try to fix it.
Or you move for a new trial. Or you move for a mistrial.
You know, I don't know what the idea was. I don't know. You know, we've all been in trials where something happened, you say, oh my God, I never saw that coming. Legitimate, I never saw that coming, you know. But the issue here is, and I have to say, I think it's becoming an increasing issue with all the electronic discovery, and you can get a gazillion depositions and all that. These changes at trial, in my experience, have becoming more and more. And my point is, we shouldn't have to be here discussing who should have done what when the violation was clear at the time and it should have ended there.
Has the practice of law changed so much that attorneys, when they realize they have something new, don't call up their adversary and say, here, I just discovered this?
I have in every one of my pretrial exchanges a standard line demanding all McKinney changes.
And that professional courtesy is going by the wayside?
I'd like to say it's going. It's unfortunately in many cases gone. It's just gone. And it's because we're busy. It's because of lots of reasons, good reasons and bad reasons. But the issue here, as far as I'm concerned, yeah, I can say, gee, I would have objected on 152 different grounds. And maybe the judge would have gone one way, maybe the judge would have gone the other way. I have no idea. The issue here is, what do we do to make sure that the integrity of the discovery system remains and that we don't have to worry about these last-minute impossible decisions that trial lawyers have to make? And that's why we've suggested the remedy that we've suggested, as well as the amendment of the rules, so that this can't happen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Kuala, could you want to offer a brief rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. Really, the only thing I wanted to make note of, plaintiff's counsel was discussing the appellate division opinion where they said that the absence of an objection is not dispositive of whether parties were prejudiced. And the court there cited Chetsina versus PC Holding Corp. And in a footnote in that case, the appellate division cautioned trial counsel that the decision in the case is premised on the particularly outrageous nature of the conduct at issue combined with other factors. And in that case, I believe it was the plaintiff's counsel, though it may have been defense counsel. No, in fact, it was defense counsel. Made repeated and numerous derisive comments about parties, witnesses, attorneys, really just generally unprofessional stuff. And I don't see how that translates in this case. I think that the footnote there indicated that the court intended that exception to be a very, very rare one and not applicable in this situation. Beyond that, unless anyone has any questions, I'll rely on my brief.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel for the helpful arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement.